Support for KHOI comes from Stevens Auditorium, presenting the Havana Cuba All-Stars on their debut tour of the United States with a program of songs and music celebrating the musical legacy of Cuba. More information can be found at center.iastate.edu. Welcome to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, where we explore people, stories, and events in Central Iowa. Hello to you, the listener. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Gail Seiler, your host for today. It's a lovely fall day here in Iowa following a beautiful weekend. However, last week and the weekend were very eventful. A devastating hurricane hit Haiti and parts of the United States. And of course, we have the continuing saga of the presidential campaigns with the town hall last night. We have an interesting mix of stories for you today that will give you hopefully a little respite from maybe some of the negative things that we have going on and hearing about. But it will also be informative and thought-provoking. Later in the show, we'll be discussing the holiday that's called Columbus Day in most places, but is taking on different names in some places, the second Monday of October. We'll be talking about the movement to abolish Columbus Day, so stay tuned for that. First, we're going to hear about an exciting event that will be happening in Ames, sponsored by the Ames Children's Choir. You've heard of them, I'm sure, but this is a new and somewhat unusual event for them. And to tell us about it, we have Mary Kay Palaszczuk and Wendy Pixler from the Ames Children's Choir. Good morning, both.
Good morning.
Good to have you here. Thank you for coming in so early.
Thank you for having us.
First, tell us, what are your roles in the choir?
I have been a parent of a singer in the choir since the very beginning. My last of four children is now singing. And I am currently the Ames Children's Choir Board President.
And Wendy?
I also have a daughter in the choir and serve on the board.
I didn't realize that it was that kind of organization where people would have children in it, but also be so involved in the day-to-day running of it. That's impressive. This new event that's happening is Ames Has Talent. So what is Ames Has Talent?
We were looking for an opportunity for the Ames and area students to showcase their talent. And so last year we came up with the idea of fashioning it after America's Got Talent, not, you know, claiming that name, but Ames Has Talent. And so last year we had our first event. It was very successful. It was rather small, but the kids had a good time. We had fantastic judges, and we gave out trophies and gift cards, and everybody went home feeling really great about what they had done for the day.
So this is the second year?
Yes.
But you're hoping to ramp it up and enlarge it a bit this year?
We're hoping that we have more participants. It's a little hard sometimes to get the word out, and we didn't do as good of a job last year as we would have liked, and hopefully this year we'll have more students participating.
So hopefully that being here on the radio telling us about it will help with that. Give us the specifics first. When and where is it?
It is Sunday, the one coming up, Sunday, October 16th. It is at 2 p.m. at the Northminster Presbyterian Church.
Okay. And how does someone participate? What's the expectations, or how does that work?
The expectation is that they will have an act either singing, dancing, playing the piano, playing an instrument. They could do an improv. We haven't really put necessarily any restrictions on what that talent is. There is a time limit. No more than five people are allowed. And I forget what the time limit is.
3 minutes.
3 minutes. This year we are excited that we have a good piano there, so piano students will be a little more excited. Last year we just had a keyboard, and so that's a very good thing for pianists interested in participating.
And will there be the possibility of, say, a singer who wants to have some background music, bring it on tape or digitally or whatever? Will that be possible?
Yes, we had a few students who did that last time.
Even though it's sponsored by the Ames Children's Choir, it doesn't have to just be singing.
Correct.
This year we've expanded it to vocal category, instrumental category, and a theatrical category, which can be theater or dance, improv. And we also have categories for age. So kindergarten through fifth grade compete, and sixth grade through 12th grade compete. And I'm in charge of the trophies, so I want everyone to know we bought a lot of trophies. So if you come, you will more than likely win a trophy. And the kids loved that last year.
So who are the judges? Or there are judges, multiple judges?
Yes, we have judges in the area of dance and vocal and piano, and we're not sharing that information at the moment.
but kind of expertise in the different forms of performing arts. So it's for performing arts broadly, I guess we could say. Okay. And different categories, prizes in different categories. And when do young people have to register, or how do they register?
They can register by we've been sending emails and things into digital backpacks. So they can email. They can also go online and register at Ames Children's Choir. You can talk to any of the board members that they've heard from.
What's digital backpack? Maybe explain that for people.
In the old days, students would get papers that they would take home on Fridays, and you would hope that your child took them out of the backpack. Now we have digital backpacks. I'm guessing most schools send them everything via email instead of giving paper.
So you're working with the school district. Wendy, were you going to say something?
I was going to say that I think we need to contact Sean right now at, is it info@ameschildrenschoir.org?
Yes.
Okay, because the website is currently down right now. So
usually
they could get this off the website. But if you contact Sean and let her know what you're wanting to enter, that would be fine.
Say that email again then.
It's info@ameschildrenschoir.org.
Okay. If it's going home in the digital backpack, then you must be collaborating with the school district somewhat on this. I saw it on their website also. I was looking at their website on something else, and there was information about it there. Yeah. So that seems to be a good way to reach out to students.
Yes. We want all the students in Ames to feel free to come and have a good time and compete.
Okay. Last year, would you say most of the students who participated were also involved in the children's choir, or were there students who weren't in the choir?
I think only one was in the choir.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, no. This is definitely outreach to those people and trying to just build more avenues that the kids in Ames can combine to get talent together, I guess.
And it could be single acts, or it could be a group performing together?
Yes, up to five.
Okay. All right. Yeah. You don't want a whole choir up there on the stage. Did you say is there a deadline for registering?
They like to know by October 10th, but there's not really a deadline. We even take them at the door.
Okay.
You know, if people just want to come and pay the registration fee and join, that's fine too.
We had a program last year, and it's nice to have everybody on the program, so that's one of the reasons we want them to register soon enough that we can put a program together and have that.
Get their name in print and their act, perhaps, what they're going to do. We've all heard of America's Got Talent, but you decided to change the name a little bit. Ames Has Talent. Was there any particular reason for that?
We didn't want to be copycatters with the exact same thing. And we struggled a little bit. We have a tremendous amount of talent in the greater Ames area. And just saying Ames was nice and short and succinct, but we want to make sure everybody understands this is for the greater Ames area.
Okay, so this could also be young people who go to schools in the surrounding areas as well, not just Ames schools.
Yes, we also sent something to Boone.
Okay.
So I know we did that.
Okay, so not just students who live in Ames.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Okay. And what was the age limits again?
Kindergarten through fifth, and then sixth through 12th.
Okay, so all the way up through high school. Mm-hmm. And I did notice in looking at the information, the registration information, there was a entry fee. Do you think that may be a hardship or deter some young people from participating?
It potentially could be. I would hope that if somebody had that issue, that they would feel free to contact us and see what we could do to help them.
Why did Ames Children's Choir really want to do this? It sounds like a pretty big undertaking.
It was an opportunity for the Ames children to showcase what they can do. They might have local school talent shows, but we felt that maybe some students didn't have that opportunity and wanted to participate in something else that would show that for them.
Okay, so just really give an opportunity for students to be seen. And
it also gives an opportunity for the children to be before an audience mm-hmm. and to try things out mm-hmm. in a realm that's not necessarily, I don't know, a high-level performance where they can try things out. They're before an audience. They're going to get rewarded and get trophies and prizes and have it be a positive experience.
So a positive experience that mm-hmm. might build their confidence and make them more comfortable doing that kind of thing.
Yeah. Yeah. Last time we had Jason Paul as an MC, who was just fantastic on introducing the kids, encouraging them, congratulating them when they were done.
Wonderful, yeah. And anyone can come to watch this.
Yes, we encourage audience.
And so tell us one more time when and where so people can get it in their calendars.
It is on this coming Sunday, October 16th at 2 p.m. at Northminster Presbyterian Church on 20th Street by the railroad tracks there, okay. up by the high school.
Okay. And we'll have links to the webpage if it gets up and running again, but also this email mm-hmm. Address that students can use to register or get other information if they have questions and so on. Anything else you want to share with us about it?
No, I did find a phone number, though,
okay.
for Sean.
Oh, good.
So this is 515-290-1422.
Okay, and we can put that on our website, too, for people.
Yeah, that's really important since our website's down right now.
Okay, all right. Again, thanks for coming in and sharing this with us, and we hope you get a good turnout, and both of performers and audience.
Thank you for having
Thank
us.
Thank you.
You're listening to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio. That was a little more of our theme song, Backtrackin'. Today, October 10th, the second Monday in October, is a holiday known as Columbus Day. And we're going to delve into the story behind that holiday and some controversy around it. Columbus Day first became a federal holiday in 1937, and in 1970, the holiday was fixed on the second Monday in October. The states of Hawaii, Alaska, Oregon, and South Dakota don't recognize Columbus Day at all. And I saw this morning on the internet that Vermont, the governor just proclaimed there that the name was changed to Indigenous Peoples Day. South Dakota celebrates the day as Native American Day. Oregon does not recognize Columbus Day at all as a holiday or any kind of commemoration. And interestingly, Iowa and Nevada do not celebrate Columbus Day as an official holiday, but the governors are, quote, authorized and requested, unquote, by statute to proclaim the day each year. So we have Columbus Day here in Iowa because of that proclamation. Berkeley, California, was the first municipality to replace Columbus Day with Indigenous Peoples Day, and that was in 1992. And other cities have done that: Minneapolis, Seattle, Missoula, Montana, and Cambridge, Massachusetts, and I think the latest are Denver and Phoenix. So this is a growing trend. You might wonder, what's the problem with Columbus Day? Why would we want to abolish it or change the name? To find out more about that, I interviewed Bill Bigelow, who is the curriculum editor of Rethinking Schools, as well as the co-director of the Zinn Project, and he was a high school social studies teacher in Oregon for 30 years. Let's talk first about what is the conventional story of Columbus.
Yeah, well, the conventional story is that this brave explorer came across the Atlantic Ocean and planted his flag for Spain and claimed the land and named it San Salvador. And, you know, in the beginning there was Columbus, and he was good, and so were we.
Very neat story. Well, what is the real story of what occurred?
Well, the real story is that Columbus, you know, he called it La Empresa, the enterprise, and he came looking to get rich, and he came as an imperialist. He came representing an empire, and when he first began encountering people, he said all kinds of nice things about them, but he also talked about how he could exploit them. And on his third day in the Americas, he wrote, "With 50 men, we could subjugate them all and make them do whatever we want." And so he enslaved people. He was the father of the slave trade, as Basil Davidson calls him, and he initiated policies to extract gold from the Taino people and had their hands chopped off if they did not deliver enough gold, had them chased down with vicious dogs and attacked. And in the words of Bartolome de las Casas, the Dominican priest who witnessed some of this, that Columbus was, he ordered his men to spread terror. So he was the first European terrorist in the Americas as well. And so that, you know, in a nutshell, he was not a representative of goodness and democracy, and is really not worthy of having children throughout the Americas celebrate him.
Yeah. And can you explain, for people who might not know, who the Taino were?
Yeah, the Taino were the indigenous people of the Caribbean, and on the island that sort of Columbus made his base, Hispaniola, which is, you know, today the Dominican Republic and Haiti, there were at least several hundred thousand of them, and perhaps more. There are estimates anywhere from 3 to 10 million. So
Wow. There
were huge numbers of them, and they were, you know, Columbus's son, who was also Fernando, who was Columbus's biographer, says that Columbus told him that in the first 4 years between 1492 and 1496, that two-thirds of the Tainos were killed or died in various ways. And so, you know, who knows the numbers that we're talking about? Another of Columbus's biographers said that Columbus's policies toward the indigenous people in the Caribbean led to complete genocide. This is Samuel Elliott Morrison. Now, he's a big fan of Columbus, but even he acknowledges the huge, you know, Holocaust there.
And it wasn't just Columbus. It was also his men who carried out a lot of these brutal acts.
Sure, yeah. I mean, he came with his second voyage with, you know, 17 ships and, you know, maybe 1,200 men. That was really the kind of the invasion with horses and the attack dogs and all the rest. He did not do it all by himself.
And that was several years later.
Well, it was the next year.
Okay.
So he made four voyages in all, yeah.
Uh-huh. So how has this conventional narrative, which is so different from what you just described, been perpetuated?
Well, you know, I think that the thing is, it's not, the problem is not with what went on 500 years ago. The problem is with what children still too often learn. And they learn they learn a narrative of whose lives matter and whose lives don't. And so, you know, Columbus, the great explorer, the white people who came, we learn their names. We don't learn the names of the people who were here. We don't learn anything about them. The most typical kind of children's book on Columbus, you know, will show, you know, that iconic that iconic picture of mm-hmm. Columbus kneeling on the beach and planting the flag, and there are his men around him. And, you know, we'll see these sort of voiceless, you know, Indians there, but their lives really don't matter. And what we learn about is the naming, you know, San Salvador, not being told that the place already had a name. It was called Guanahani by the Tainos who were there. And we learn kind of nothing about their lives. No, there's no curiosity. There's no question raised mm-hmm. about what right did Columbus have to do this. You know, he was coming thousands of miles from another country. And so children are just taught that this is just sort of the normal thing. This is okay. And so it really, it encourages kids implicitly to embrace colonialism, to this idea that some people in the world have the right to rule over other people.
Mm-hmm. And that those people are somehow better and more important. And
they are. And, you know, and there's nothing really explicit said about that. Yeah. There's no book that I've ever read that says, well, because Columbus was white, he got to rule over. But, you know, kids are smart. They're, you know, I have a 7-year-old grandson, and they're trying to puzzle stuff out all the time. And so, you know, you can imagine, well, what distinguishes Columbus from these other people? Well, he's white, they're not. He's armed and they're not, so might makes right. Or he's Christian and they're not. Mm-hmm. Or he's coming from, you know, a more technologically developed, at least in some respects, society. So people from those kind of societies have a right to rule over others. But, you know, whatever it is, kids are being invited, urged to embrace this kind of fundamental kind of cleavage in the world between the people who have a right to make decisions, sort of the real people, and then the people who, you know, Eduardo Galeano calls los nadies, the nobodies, the people who have no rights.
So it's clear who benefits from the perpetuation of this myth about Columbus and who doesn't benefit.
And this is the problem, because it really sort of launches kids on a kind of curricular voyage where these kinds of myths get repeated, that where, you know, some people's lives matter and other people's lives don't, and you know, pay attention to the winners, pay attention to the people on top and the people who matter, and then, you know, just accept the fact that there are all these sort of non-entities out there who you don't need to worry about.
I think you could connect that to, and I think you do in some of your writings, connect that to systems of oppression that are still operating in society today and controversies and issues that are going on now.
Well, that's what we want to do. I mean, we want to, you know, we want to connect the past and the present, and to let kids know that the kind of, you know, the kind of critical capacities that we're hoping to develop in them as they look at you know, Columbus or the U.S. war with Mexico or the whatever, we want them to bring that kind of analysis forward.
Would you see this connected to the Black Lives Matter movement or other movements happening today?
It very definitely is connected to Black Lives Matter. I mean, Black Lives Matter is insisting that Black Lives Matter, that you can't erase human beings, and that people count. And that's, you know, in fundamental opposition to what the Columbus story is teaching. The Columbus story is teaching that, no, not everybody does count. Some people count, and they happen to be white, and other people don't count. And so so Black Lives Matter is an insistence that that's not okay anymore. You know, one of the things that I do with my students, just to underscore this, I ask them, I start out, I say, well, yeah, who is that guy they say, you know, discovered America, what was his name? And, you know, everybody will say Columbus. And I say, well, yeah, and who was here? Who was, you know, I mean, who did he supposedly discover? And, you know, some kids will say Indians. I'll say, mm-hmm. yeah, but what particular nationality? What were their names? And, you know, in 30 years, I've never had anybody be able to say the Tainos. And I say, well, what does that tell us? What does that tell us that we know all this stuff about this guy named Columbus, but we don't know anything, not even the names of the people who were here? And clearly, you know, what out of discussion it comes out is that, well, they just didn't matter. That what mattered was this kind of story of progress and the sort of the arrival of kind of us, which is the, you know, the kind of European story of development.
And the Dakota Access Pipeline is a big controversial topic here in Iowa, and there's been a lot of resistance to it, both in the planning stages and now in the construction stages, because it would cut diagonally across the state. And, of course, there's been resistance to it in North Dakota that's gotten quite a bit of press, and we've actually interviewed people there on this show. How is that connected to this idea of the Columbus myth?
Well, I think one of the things is that they're reminding us that indigenous people were here first and that they have rights and that they have treaty rights and that those treaty rights are paramount. I think that the movement actually to abolish Columbus Day and to establish Indigenous Peoples Day and the movement to assert treaty rights and to block the pipeline, and here in the Northwest, the movement by the Yakima people to stop coal exports down the Columbia River. The Lummi people just successfully stopped a coal export plant up at Cherry Point in the Bellingham area. And so that really we all benefit in a world of climate change and the need to kind of keep fossil fuels in the ground. We really all benefit tremendously when the rights of indigenous people are exercised to protect their lands and their water and in the process protect us all.
Could you say a bit more about the movement to abolish Columbus Day? How much has that taken hold?
Well, you know, it's been very encouraging that I think the first community, maybe not surprisingly, in the country to do this was Berkeley back in 1992. In fact, the book that we produced, Rethinking Columbus, which came out in 1991, drew inspiration from a whole movement of, you know, the American Indian movement and different communities of color around the country who were working to, you know, to question the celebration, the 500th anniversary of Columbus. And it was out of that challenge to the 500th anniversary celebrations that were planned that people began challenging the whole idea of having a day to honor Columbus. And so Berkeley, I think, was the first back in 1992. But now it's become really kind of like a wildfire that there are, you know, every week I think that there are schools and school districts that are establishing Indigenous Peoples Day in place of Columbus Day. Here in Portland, the school district has an official, it's Indigenous Peoples Day. Here it's not Columbus Day. Yeah. And that's true, you know, the city of Seattle, the city of Portland, there are other places around the country. The National Council for the Social Studies is having this come up at its conference in December as well.
And have things gotten better in schools in terms of how it's addressed just generally by teachers?
Yeah, I think it has. I think it, you know, there are surely places where little kind of bubbles where the story remains unchanged. But I think that there's just been a lot more scholarship. There is a lot more curriculum at the Zinn Education Project. The most downloaded activity that we have for teachers is an activity on the trial of Columbus. So there's just a lot of critical curriculum that teachers can rely on now. So I think I think it is better, and I think that the text materials, they've responded to the critique. They respond in ways that still, for whatever reason, try to protect Columbus and try and downplay the nature of the imperial project that Columbus brought. You know, it's called the Encounter, and so a lot of times the textbooks will, you know, well, we obviously the Europeans got from indigenous people the potato and corn, and they got, you know, horses and coffee, and so there's this sort of equal exchange that's put forward even as more of the truth is acknowledged in the text material. So it, you know, it's an ongoing struggle, but I think that things are better.
So somewhat better, but still kind of presenting it as a mutually beneficial encounter.
It is. In fact, let me share with you, I do a workshop on Rethinking Columbus, and so I try and find newish materials that we can look at together. And this is from a Houghton Mifflin book, Social Studies, United States History, The Early Years. And the very final question on the Columbian Exchange, there's a section on the Columbian Exchange, is how did the Columbian Exchange change the diet of Europeans? That's the only question. And so that, this birth of the slave trade, the genocidal policies in the Americas get reduced to the fact that Europeans got to eat tomatoes or potatoes or whatever.
And just calling it the, what was the phrase, Columbian Exchange?
Well, the Columbian Exchange. It began with the Smithsonian back in 1992 when, they had to acknowledge the existence of the Tainos and indigenous people, but wanted to avoid, terms like genocide or invasion, and so settled on this kind of, myth of the encounter and the exchange, which really took, kind of stripped all the power relations out of the story. It wasn't, it was hardly an exchange when they came taking slaves and forcing people to search for gold.
In working with pre-service teachers at ISU, one thing I often hear from them, particularly those who will be teaching in the early grades, kindergarten, first and second, when, we talk about this, is that they say things like, how can I talk about what really happened with very young students? So what kind of guidance would you give to teachers or parents even of young students to start a more realistic understanding of this?
Yeah, first of all, I'm not sure that it's particularly developmentally appropriate to study Columbus, quote Columbus, in like first or second grade. I know that my own grandson, he's in second grade, his teacher, she just doesn't do anything because she feels like she cannot not talk about sort of what happened and doesn't want to talk about that with him. I think that teachers can talk about, they can certainly study the Tainos and honor the lives of the people who were here first. There's a book by Michael Doris called Morning Girl, which it's not without its own problems, but it simply tells the story from these kids, these Taino kids' standpoint, in the summer of 1492, so before Columbus comes. And so the very last page, then, you sort of see, Columbus's ship off in the distance, or ships off in the distance. And so, it really literally takes Columbus, off the page, and makes the Tainos, puts the Tainos at the center of the story, which I think is a nice, nice thing to do. And there are, there are books, there's more literature all the time about the Tainos. And so that's one thing that kids can do. I think that teachers can also think about language with children. One of the things that I do in my U.S. history class, I think that teachers could do it younger grade, and have done it younger grades too, which is I start by stealing a student's purse. The young woman whose purse it is knows that I'm going to do this, but nobody else does. And so, I grab a purse off her desk, and I say, "This is my purse." And kids are like, "No, it's not. It's her purse." And then I start taking stuff out, and people are really upset. Mm-hmm. You can't do that. It's her purse. And I say, "Oh, no, this is my purse. This is, this is my lipstick. This is my brush. This is," and then I'll sort of join with them and say, "Okay, well, let's prove it's not mine. It's Nikki's purse. How do you know it's Nikki's purse? Well, we saw you take it. Okay, but now I've got it. Well, that's her brush." And so at the end of it, I say, "Well, okay, I see. Let's say that I discovered Nikki's purse. Now it makes it mine, doesn't it?" And so we begin looking at language, and we say that Columbus discovered America. What words did you apply to what I did to Nikki's purse? Well, I stole it. I ripped it off. And so why don't we use that language in talking about Columbus? And so I think that sort of just reframing what happened without necessarily talking about the hands being chopped off and the brutality and all that, I think is certainly possible.
Well, thank you so much for taking the time to talk with us.
Okay, thanks, Gail.
You're listening to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio. That was an interview with Bill Bigelow, who works with two organizations, Rethinking Schools and the Zinn Project, that are committed to public education's role in creating a humane, multiracial democracy. I was interested in finding out what was going on in local schools in relation to the Columbus holiday, so I contacted several people in the educational system in Iowa to find out if there were any local positions, statements, or recommendations for schools regarding the teaching of Columbus. I contacted Stephanie Wager, who is the social studies consultant at the Iowa Department of Education. Her reply was that she could not speak to these things as a state employee. And she did not reply to my specific question asking, does the Department of Education have a policy, statement, or recommendation regarding the teaching of Columbus? Locally, I reached out to Ames Community Schools. I contacted Dr. Mandy Ross, Associate Superintendent in Ames, who said that they do not have a district position on Columbus Day in Ames either. They are currently revising their social studies curriculum, so she mentioned that it is something that she believes will be considered when that revision is worked on. Because there does not seem to be a policy in place to guide teachers about Columbus in most places here in Iowa, I wanted to hear from teachers. So in the studio with me now is a teacher, Greg Wickenkamp, who is a graduate student in the School of Education at ISU, and a former middle school teacher in Iowa. Welcome, Greg.
Thank you. It's so good to be here.
Good to have you here. When you were growing up, what was the initial image and story that you got about Columbus? Was it similar to what Bill Bigelow described as the conventional story?
Oh, yeah. I mean, you know, like most, my recollection of what I've learned in elementary school is a little hazy, but I definitely came away with the impression that Columbus sort of, quote unquote, discovered America. He's a great hero. This idea of sort of inevitable progress leading to the founding of our country.
And when did that change? When did you kind of learn the true story of Columbus or gain this other perspective?
So, yeah, I was very lucky to have some good teachers, access to really good books, good parents who challenged me to think critically. That being said, I don't know if I still know the story of the true Columbus, but I'm learning more, and that's really exciting. And it wasn't until high school, I think, when I started questioning, and then college, when I really started to develop more of a critical thought about an informed opinion about informed knowledge about Columbus.
So you were a middle school teacher.
I was.
What grades and subjects did you teach?
Yeah, I was very fortunate to teach sixth grade social studies and occasionally language arts.
Okay.
Academically, yeah.
And how did you approach teaching about Columbus or the time around the holiday when you were teaching middle school?
So before I went into teaching, I was a classroom aide, a teacher's aide. And there I definitely was guilty of teaching sort of this uncritical Columbus myth. I look back on that now and think about what that might have done to my students of color who maybe never saw themselves as a hero in the classroom, or my students of European ancestry who saw their ancestors sort of unquestionably dominating others, and how that might affect them. So in my own classroom then, it didn't fit exactly into our curriculum, but I felt, you know, in sixth grade, really the need to address it. So the first thing we did is we looked at what students already knew, and then based on that, I would find primary sources to kind of challenge those myths and let students sort of construct their own understanding of Columbus, which I think in history we really want to let students do. And then from there, we use that to sort of critique our textbook and look at, well, what does our textbook say about Columbus, and why do you think they left all this out? And so that was really empowering, and students liked that. You know, if you give students permission to critique the textbook, whoa, that's an exciting thing. So we had a lot of fun with it. The challenge, of course, like Bill mentioned, is to make age-appropriate things, especially for younger grades. I could see that being a challenge.
So were you able to find resources to bring in to expand students' perspectives on Columbus?
Oh, definitely. And the Zinn Project was very helpful in that, finding sort of the primary documents that showed Columbus and his men, their attitudes towards this new continent and towards the peoples. Yeah, definitely we were able to find age-appropriate things. And then to supplement it, too, with stories of other explorers from places outside of Europe who might have engaged in transcontinental travel.
You were a user of the Zinn Project that Bill Bigelow mentioned. And some of their highly downloaded resources.
Definitely, yeah. What a great resource. Yeah. You know, the textbooks are slower moving and slower to respond to new evidence. So finding new resources like that is always exciting as a teacher.
Mm-hmm. And when students came into your class, you said you started with what did they already know. And they kind of reproduced that conventional narrative?
Oh, most definitely. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we have a lot of really good teachers doing really good work, but there's a lot of other education that students are getting about Columbus sort of implicitly, this mix of half-truths that sort of uphold this idea of Westerners as heroes. You know, they would come with the idea that, oh, he discovered America. He proved the world wasn't flat. He thought he was in India, but he was still very brave, these sorts of half-truths. Yeah.
Some people might say, what's the big deal? What difference does it make if students have the wrong idea about Columbus or if we celebrate it as a holiday? What difference does it make? What would you say as a teacher?
Sure. I think Bill Bigelow said it very well. You know, when we think about history, it shows us whose voices matter, whose lives matter. And, I mean, the question is really why study history at all? And we want to let students learn from the mistakes and the successes of the past. We want to let students know that history is not sort of a linear progression that's very neat, but evolving arguments based on new evidence all the time that students must construct, you know. And especially with young students, history is a way they can form their identities and values. And the Columbus story, unfortunately, doesn't help in any of these areas. If anything, it kind of goes against a lot of these things. You know, it gives students this linear progression, this unquestioning narrative. It doesn't mention the other voices of the people already in the Americas or the other explorers who could equally highlight what bravery and courage might mean to young people. The thing that the Columbus story does is it shows a history where one group dominates another, and that's remains unquestioned. So the Columbus story, we can include the accurate versions of it, and we should, but we should also include other voices and other examples of cultures getting along without dominating one another, or heroes from other cultures that students can emulate. And so, you know, this story of Columbus as it's traditionally told, it almost recolonizes the minds of young people so that they are unable to sort of learn from these mistakes of the past rather than building off of them.
And students get these messages, these narratives about Columbus as hero and from many different sources, as you mentioned, not just from teachers, not just from schools. But so do you see teachers as having a responsibility to kind of recognize this and do more to go beyond the standard curriculum?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, we want to empower students to sort of understand the world that they're coming into and be able to transform it in positive ways. And if we teach students the critical thinking skills that an alternative or a more holistic approach to Columbus might, they can be empowered and they can learn from the past mistakes. And as educators, that's what we want for our students.
So let's go back to when you were talking about things you did in your class.
Yeah.
What kinds of reactions did you get from the students first and then maybe from others, from other teachers or even from parents, if there were any reactions?
Sure. Maybe most would expect me to say, oh, there was tremendous pushback, but there really wasn't. Students love learning, and if they can learn in a way that's sort of challenging and honest, they appreciate that. They really appreciate being able to critique things in the classroom and critique authority and question authority. And I think to allow them to do that is really, really an exciting thing. So that, you know, my students were brilliant. They're going to be transforming the world. Parents, they want what's best for students. They want their students to think critically and those critical thinking skills. And so once parents see that that's what you're doing in the classroom, they tend to be very supportive. Teachers also, you know, they understand that students need hard critical thinking skills. They need to be able to weigh evidence. They need to be able to see facts and not just repeat narratives that they've heard in the past. And so they're generally supportive. You know, anytime there is pushback, for me, that's kind of a learning opportunity, both either for myself or the person pushing back or more most likely both. So I welcome that in my teaching. That's kind of exciting too.
I was also curious about teaching the lower grades, like Bill Bigelow mentioned. So I contacted Gloria Dahl, a former elementary teacher in the area. And she was not able to be with us this morning, but she supplied some information to me, and she recalled when she taught kindergarten. And she said, and I'm quoting her, "After doing some research, I decided that it was inappropriate for me to present and teach about Columbus in the light that it had been traditionally presented. I also decided, due to the age of my students, that they were not developmentally ready for me to be able to give them accurate information about him as an explorer. So I chose to eliminate that piece from the curriculum." So similar to what Bill Bigelow suggested, to highlight other aspects of the history, for example, of the Tainos. She also shared some advice for teachers. "I would always encourage teachers to carefully research their topics for themselves and also to look at a variety of sources in the materials they were using to ensure that they were being historically accurate and sensitive to the cultures that were being taught and represented." So even in lower grades, teachers have to really be kind of thoughtful and not just necessarily go along with the standard approach to teaching things.
Right. I mean, you know, we want to help our students. And if, I mean, we can't do that in unfactual stories or ahistorical stories. You know, we want to teach them values of courage and things, but we want to do that in an honest way. So I think that's a great answer from Gloria, yeah.
I also checked in with a parent who has a child in a local school in second grade this year. And she showed me some worksheets that her child has brought home from schools, local schools, over the past year or two. And they included a word puzzle and an activity in which students were to write a short paragraph about Columbus using words in a word bank. So these are common activities in elementary school.
Oh, yeah.
What's interesting is the words that were in the word bank. So the words in the word bank included things like sailors, new world, Nina, queen, voyage, discover, and so on. And as Bill Bigelow pointed out, there was no mention of the Tainos, the indigenous people who were living on those Caribbean islands. And this was a first grade assignment, so we can already see how that conventional whitewashed myth of Columbus was already being planted in students' minds.
Yeah. I mean, there's always the temptation. Teachers are very busy.
Yeah.
There's always the temptation to do something fun with the holidays without sort of critically examining them. And, you know, there's always the temptation to just use the easy resources that are available when we're pressed for time or don't have the extra teacher's aid. So that's a real challenge, and right. I think that shows exactly how this sort of uncritical thinking or uncritical teaching just happens all too often.
And were there any other teachers in your school who were doing these kinds of things, or was there any school-wide effort or recognition?
Yeah, that's a good question. I was very fortunate in that I got to teach the whole grade. And so
all the sixth graders.
Right, yeah. And so that was really, really an opportunity. So I'm not exactly sure how other teachers approached it. I know like Gloria Dolly did not address it in her classroom. And I'm not sure where it would fit into the curriculum of maybe the higher grades at my school that I was at. So I'm not exactly sure. I know that there are teachers all over, colleagues that I have, friends that I have, who are doing exciting things about Columbus and really teaching a true history, giving students sort of the historical skills they might need. You know, with school-wide efforts, I think it's harder because schools, like all organizations, have people in positions of power that make it sort of hard to change, especially if that change involves sort of challenging popular narratives that might reinforce cultural dominance. But it's exciting to see these schools and cities across the nation replacing Columbus Day with Indigenous Peoples Day. That's exciting.
Yeah. And it's also exciting to think about schools taking the lead in that because in some places it's the school districts who instituted policies or statements or recommendations, and then the municipality followed after that. So that's kind of exciting to think that schools and maybe students can take the lead in some of this push.
It really is, yeah. You know, these changes obviously will not come from the top because those places are sort of resistant to change naturally. But you see communities and you see parents and teachers sort of working together to say, let's really think about how we can solve these big issues of the day. Well, it goes back to sort of decolonizing our students' minds and letting them be able to explore history in a realistic way.
Well, I think we're about out of time. So thanks very much, Greg Wickenkamp, ISU School of Education graduate student and former middle school teacher. Thanks for coming in and talking with us about this.
Thanks so much for having me.
This is KHOI Community Radio, and you've been listening to Local Talk. I've been your host, Gail Seiler. Thanks to all our guests and interviewees, Mary Kay Palaszczuk and Wendy Pixler from the Ames Children Choir, Bill Bigelow, who had spoken with me earlier last week. He's from Rethinking Schools and the Zinn Project, and Greg Wickenkamp from ISU and a former middle school teacher. Local Talk is broadcast on KHOI at 7 a.m., noon, and 7 p.m. on Monday, Wednesday, and Friday. You can also listen to today's Local Talk show and all of our past shows online at our website, khoifm.org. Local Talk was engineered by Vincent Valeriano. Our theme song is Backtrackin' by Al Harris and Tom Richards from their CD, The Ballad of Kate Shelley. KHOI is a community radio station that is driven by volunteers and made possible by donations from individuals, businesses, and organizations. You can become a member or donate at any time on our website, khoifm.org. If you enjoyed this show, tell your friends. Remember, your participation as audience and supporter is what makes KHOI possible and meaningful. Thanks for listening, and see you again on the radio. Thank you.